All right. So welcome to this Big Book Awakening workshop. This week we are talking about there is a solution. We're going to go over the first half. Say a little prayer for us to get us started. Thank you, Father, for bringing us together tonight. Thank you for giving us the courage and the willingness to want to grow, to want to understand our disease. Help us to open our hearts and open our minds to the words in this book. Help us to relate our experience to what we're hearing, what we're thinking. Please, Father, help us to set aside everything we think we know. Enable us to have an open mind and a new experience. Help us to see the truth about our physical craving after we take the drink. Okay, so tonight is the last portion of the physical craving. So we went over assignment 5, I believe it was. We've met in our homework groups. We've had discussions, which is great. I'm glad you guys are making your groups and talking with the facilitators and kind of building this intimate relationship with a small group of men or women. It'll be very important as we move forward. We start to talk about God more, our struggles with that, share that with each other, get into our inventory process, do our fifth steps and things of that sort. So continue to make your groups and build these relationships with these new men and women that maybe we normally would not mix with, but we get to see the similarities in our journey to recovery. So this is chapter 2. There is a solution. And at the top, we wrote, review the 12 steps and how it works on page 59 and consider these two questions from page 58, paragraph 2 for each step. Is this what I want to do? And am I willing to go to any length to do this? So if we turn to page 59, the first step says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Now, each step has a spiritual principle, and I like to have you guys write them down next to the step. So the spiritual principle for our first step is the word honesty. The underlying principle in the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous is honesty. So if you like, you can write that next to the first step. And the question says, is this what I want to do? So do I want to admit that I'm powerless over alcohol? Do I want to admit that my life is unmanageable? It's a tough question. There's a level of surrender there, a level of desperation definitely required for us to move forward. And the next question is, am I willing to go to any length to do this? Now, we're going to ask these questions to ourselves as we go through each step. But tonight, we're asking them about the first step. Am I willing to go to any length to admit that I am powerless over alcohol? Am I willing to go to any length to admit that my life is unmanageable? And those are considerations for each of you on your own time in meditation, something to look at quite often. I have to take a look at them all the time.
Jason?
So it says here, we have, yes?
I don't know where you're at. Are you, what book are you in? Are you in Questions? Are you in Idiot's Guide? Or are you in the Big Book? What book are we in?
I'm in the Big Book, and I'm reading what we transcribed at the top of There is a Solution for our homework assignment 5 from the Big Book Awakening workbook.
Okay, but when you said page 50, okay, so there is a solution, okay. But when you kept saying 54 or 9, where is that?
Page 59 is where the steps are located in the big book.
Oh.
And our transcription says review the 12 steps and how it works on page 59.
Oh, I see. Okay. But we are on, there is a solution on page 17.
Correct.
Okay. Now I get it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. So this is chapter 2. There is a solution. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. And our question to ourselves is, was I as hopeless as Bill? And in the last 2 weeks, especially 2 weeks ago, we talked about underlining areas of Bill's story that we related to. And I would hope that each and every one of you dug down as deep as you possibly could, discuss those in your homework group, maybe with the sponsor. Because each of our level of hopelessness is different. But we all are trying to look for similarities and not differences. So the main thing is to understand that there is a level of desperation and hopelessness that brought me here. I want to stop, but I can't. I recognize a problem. I can't do anything about it. My life is falling apart around me, and I have no solution for it. Alcohol and drugs aren't working anymore. I still feel so empty inside. And that brings us back to the second question. Am I willing to go to any length to do this? So we don't have to relate to Bill exactly, but we do ask ourselves the question, was I as hopeless as Bill? Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. And we wrote, is there hope for me? So they're letting us know that there's many people that were as hopeless as Bill. And in fact, we can say today millions of people that were as hopeless as Bill that have solved their drink problem and in many other problems. So we're going to describe the fellowship here. It says, we are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economical, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix. So we sit here tonight. There is 18 of us. And within this small group, we have different political views. We have different economic status. We have different social groups. We have different religious backgrounds. But we all have something in common. And that's what's important. And that's what we focus on. That's what brings us together. But there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like the passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. So the steerage of the ship is at the bottom of the ship, the poverty-stricken people that couldn't afford the good spot on the ship, all the way up to the captain's table. We have a common bond. Unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. So as we begin to recover, we don't turn around and walk away and say, I've got what I've got and I don't need you anymore. It's imperative for us to continue to build the fellowship, continue to build the friendship, and to grow in understanding and effectiveness with what's going on with this small circle of fellowship that we create around us. Whereas if we walked on the dock and were saved from disaster, yeah, we were all tighter than ever for a moment, but after that, everybody's walking their separate ways. So not only are we people that normally wouldn't mix, we also stick together. We also stay together. We pick each other up when we're down. We lift each other up in prayer when needed. We listen. Most important, we listen. We understand because a lot of the times we've been through it. And finding somebody that's been through what we're going through will be imperative on this journey of trials and low spots ahead we talked about last week. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. And our number two asterisk at the bottom says the powerful cement that binds us is a mixture of equal parts of the fellowship, our common problem, this book, our common solution. And later we will look at the cornerstone on page 47 and the keystone on page 62. So this unity that we're experiencing tonight and when we talk with fellowship and sponsors and when we go to our homework groups and we're building these new relationships with other men and women, that in itself will not hold us together. And we walk all the way back to that circle and triangle in the beginning, that measuring stick, of what we must do in order to truly be whole, the service and the recovery combined with this fellowship. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. Where do we find the common solution? In this book. That's why it's so important to open this book, study this book, reread this book. Make it a part of your everyday. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. So as we follow these clear-cut directions moving forward, we can all absolutely agree on this course of action. What is required, what is necessary. And that enables us to hold each other accountable within your small group of fellowship, of course. My group is rather small, but I do utilize that to be held accountable, to talk about where I'm lacking or where I'm not acting or where I am acting in this circle and triangle, especially when things get tough. Because we truly have a way out on which each and every one of us can agree. Because we all found the solution in the same book, the same words. And the beauty of all that is we each have different experiences. And recognizing that we can all relate in a different manner, but at the same time relate to each other is the beauty of the fellowship and recognizing the solution in our life and how it works differently, but the same for each and every one of us, leading us to a place of recovery, to a place of peace. An illness of this sort, and we have come to believe it as an illness, involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him and no one is angry or hurt. But not so with the alcoholic illness, for with it there goes annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. So I don't know about any of you, but if you've gone to family members in the past and tell them, hey, I'm in treatment, I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm a drug addict, I can't stop using, the level of sympathy is nowhere near if we went to them and said, My doctor just diagnosed me with stage 2 cancer. At that point, everybody is sympathetic if they've suffered from it, empathetic even if they haven't. They're reaching out their hands, asking how they can help, what they can do for you, how they can be there for you. And that's not so with this alcoholic addiction. And it gives us this feeling of isolation. And nobody understands what I'm going through. And it's dangerous and it's scary. And that's why this fellowship is so important. And that's why it's so wonderful for us to find this common solution and the cement that binds us, even at this point in the steps, to say, you know what? I have that phenomenon of craving. And I look at 18 or 19 people here and I'm like, okay, wow, all of you have that too. Like, let's talk about that. Let's use that as our springboard to opening up to a deeper level conversation with each other. And also to understand that I'm not alone and it's not just me. It's not just me. And I'm not a bad person. I'm suffering from an illness that most people deem worse than cancer. If you really think about it, how they look down on the alcoholic, the drug addict, the overeater, the sex addict, the codependent, the controller, all these things. You've got society just looking down on you saying, can't you just get it together? Don't you have any willpower? Won't you do it for your family? And all that does is create more isolation, more self-loathing, and we have nowhere to go. And the beautiful thing is we have a solution. We have a God that loves us, and we're also surrounded with people not only that are going through it or have been through it, but then we get to be surrounded with people that also need help, and then we get to engage with them and share with them. So talk about a real common solution and a real common bond. And that's why the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is so strong. So I like to separate those two parts, the part about the cancer and how alcoholism is worse. Usually when we look at this paragraph, we see that, we say, yeah. So we take the load off. We're going easy on ourselves. But for this next page or so, we're going to go back. And we're going to recognize the damage we've done. We're going to acknowledge it internally, not to create guilt or shame, to create truth. We're here to create truth. We have to see our own truth. And as we recognize our own truth, then we begin open to go to any length to recover from this. Because it's very easy for us to minimize the damage that we've done. Sometimes we just look at the damage we did ourselves. Sometimes we just look at the damage we did the people around us, but not necessarily ourselves. Sometimes we say, oh, it wasn't that bad. Sometimes we say, oh, it was so bad, but they deserved it. There's so many ways that we can look at this. So as we go through these next few paragraphs, let's just walk it back a little bit. Because it's ugly. So it says here, not so with the alcoholic illness, for with it there goes annihilations of all things worthwhile in life. So let's take a moment just to think of the things worthwhile in life that have been destroyed behind our behaviors, our illness, our lack of compassion, our isolation, the self-loathing that we carry around, the blame that we put on other people. It engulfs all whose life touch the sufferers. All. Your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your children, your spouse, your friends, your employer, your employees, your aunts, your uncles, anybody that touches your life, it has engulfed in one way, shape, or form. It brings misunderstanding. How many times do we feel like we are misunderstood? You just don't get it. If you had my pain in my life, you'd do this too. Fierce resentment. How much blame are we carrying around in our lives? for people that truly don't deserve it. Financial insecurity. What do our finances look like? What has been a realization we've come to, or living in the past of, if I woulda, shoulda, coulda, I wouldn't be where I'm at. Disgusted friends and employers. Warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. So to scratch the surface on some of the damage we have done, we have annihilated all things worth world and life, worthwhile. Our illness has engulfed all that it's touched. It's brought misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. And we could all add to the list. Now, that's ugly. That's the disease of alcoholism and addiction. That's a separation from God in our lives. That's what that is. And that's how we act out. That's a sickness of the body, a sickness of the mind, a sickness of the will, a sickness of the heart. And those are all the things that we come here to recover. So we hope that this volume will inform and comfort those who are or who may be affected. There are many. Highly competent psychiatrists who have dealt with us have found it sometimes impossible to persuade an alcoholic to discuss his situation without reserve. So I went into, after my affair, 2012, or my last affair, let's say, because it wasn't the first time, 2012, come back home. I shared a lot of that stuff with you when I did the first half of Bill's story. Very ugly. My wife and I tried to drink it away. We decided we were going to go to counseling. So we go to counseling and we're honest. And they say, okay, what do you guys do? Well, we drink every day. We get high every day, but our marriage is falling apart. We want help. And they looked us back in the eye and said, we can't help you. You need to go to this treatment program first, and then we can help you. And so what do? So we walked out of the room. We were discouraged and disgusted and angry. We make another appointment. We go back and they ask, what do you do? You know, do you drink? No. Do you get high? No. We just have marriage problems. You see, cause I'm not about to share that with my psychiatrist. I just want problems in this area of my life. And the beauty of us being here is that we're going to disclose everything, not to this entire group, but to one person, to God and to ourselves. And we give little bits and pieces to our intimate friends and the fellowship that we feel comfortable with. It's very important to feel comfortable. Strangely enough, wives, parents, and intimate friends usually find us even more unapproachable than do the psychiatrist and the doctor. So we ask ourselves, how honest have I been with family members prior to coming into Alcoholics Anonymous? How honest have I been with close friends? Hey man, I'm struggling. Hey man, I can't control. There's a reason why, or I don't know the reason why, every time we hang out, I become the crazy drunk or the blackout drunk, or you have to remind me what I did, or I'm the guy getting in fights, or I'm the girl that ends up waking up at so-and-so's house and don't know how I got there. Help me. I need help. For some reason, we can't bring ourselves to disclose that information to other people because we're scared, because we're isolated, because we're punishing ourselves, because we feel down to our core that we're bad people. And that is not the case. And the first part of that is understanding we have an allergy. We have a physical craving. We are sick in the body. We do not react to substances as others do. One of the most important factors in walking forward in this process, conceding to my innermost self that I'm different, becoming okay with it and not beating myself up for it. So we're not willing to be honest with anybody, really. We don't want all that upper paragraph with all the damage we've done. We don't want to talk to anybody about that. There's no way.
What?
That makes us look like bad people. So then it says, and this is in italics, And of course, I'm sure all of you know anything in italics in this book is they deemed very important. It says, but the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who is properly armed with facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. So important. So true to recognize. Take yourself into your little intimate homework group. Take yourself into the honest answering of these personal questions that you're willing to verbalize because you're surrounded by ex-problem drinkers. Think about that facilitator who's been through the work. They've been through it this way. They have their own sense of peace, but they also have their own sense of understanding and sympathy, compassion for what you're going through. They're the ex-problem drinker that is gaining your confidence. And this is a confidence that we wouldn't give to anybody. We wouldn't instill this confidence in anybody else. And as we move forward and get through this work, this is a guide for us as a sponsor to understand being properly armed with facts about ourselves is what we bring to the table. We bring our experience, our own truth, our realizations, what we have seen, what we know about ourselves, and the level of action that we have taken to the table. That's how they open up. Not by asking them too many questions or prodding, probing them to open up. We open up. That's how the ex problem, that's why it says properly armed with facts about himself or herself. And that's what we do as we go through this step process, especially the inventory process, and then the level of action required afterwards. We begin to truly become armed with these facts about ourselves. And we get to share that. So this says this is a guide for a sponsee looking for a sponsor. And that's what we transcribed on the left. So if any of you are sitting there without a sponsor or you're contemplating, hey, I want a more one-on-one intimate relationship with somebody, this describes it briefly. I would say the main thing is attraction. If you are attracted to what that person has or is saying, the level of honesty or the level of facts that they know about themselves and how they're willing to be vulnerable about it, ask them to help you. It says the man who is making the approach has had the same difficulty, that he obviously knows what he's talking about. That his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he is a man with a real answer. That he has no attitude of holier than thou. Nothing whatever except the sincere desire to be helpful. That there are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are the conditions we have found most effective. And in the asterisks, we wrote, was he or she like me? Does he or she live that way anymore? And does he or she have the answer for me? So, excuse me, this is something we want to bring to the table. Especially a sincere desire to be helpful and no attitude of holier than thou. And that's why I was very adamant in the beginning about letting you guys know that I'm just as sick as you are. I'm just another alcoholic addict. I'm doing this for one reason only, so that I don't get loaded. And yes, it's coming in an altruistic form. I'm not looking for anything in return. I have everything to gain. I believe that this program and process will work for me. That's why I'm here. And there is a sincere desire to be helpful, but most important, no attitude of holier than thou. No attitude of spiritual giant or spiritual guru. That is ridiculous. Coming from me. I see people in the program that I'm like, man, I want that. I want to be like that. But I want to make it clear to you guys that I struggle at each and every day. I have to work very hard at this. And there's a certain, though it's getting smaller, there is a certain part of my spirit that wants to fight it. And I have to acknowledge that and recognize that. So if you feel that or if you see that, please don't get discouraged. Call me. I'll share with you my own struggles and how there are times when I'm carrying around a lot of doubt, a lot of fear, a lot of worry. And there's a lot of times where I sit in front of this computer before all of you show up asking myself, what am I doing? How can I say anything that's worth anything? And that's the self-loathing in me, this low self-worth that likes to rear its ugly head. But all it does for me today is it helps me to acknowledge I need to continue. I need help. I'm just like you guys. We're all here together. This is what we're doing. We're just trying to recover from an illness that's worse than cancer. And if we're the real deal, it's going to kill us. And if it doesn't kill us physically, it's going to kill us spiritually, which would be like the Walking Dead, which might be worse. So you need to really, really contemplate that. So none of us makes a sole vocation of this work, nor do we think its effectiveness would be increased if we did. So we're all busy. You're like, wait a minute, you want me to show up at a workshop and then show up at a homework group, and then you're telling me I got 3 hours of homework a week, and then you want me to go to two meetings a week. And then when I'm all done, you want me to start working with two, three people a week? None of us makes a sole vocation, meaning this is all we do. We all have lives. I believe the more that I try to balance it, the more trouble I get in. So I take this mess and it's all on this plate and I throw it up to God. I say, you got to balance it. Just show me. And I'm going to ask you how to do that one day at a time. And I'm going to ask you to allow me to be of service and put somebody in my path that needs some help today. And it comes in so many different forms. So what we're going to read next is a hint. It's, there's a word for it in the movies and I can't think about it. I can't think of it right now. It's not coming to mind. But it's showing us what's coming. It says, we feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. Very important line in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can highlight it, you can circle it, you can memorize it. Not a lot of people talk about it. It's a hard statement to grasp. It says, we feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. So wait a minute. You're telling me I couldn't stop. My life is falling apart. I feel like crap. I'm desperate. I'm broken. I'm crying. I need help. I'm homeless. I'm in jail. I'm in treatment. I'm in sober living. Oh my God, I have 60 days of sobriety. Oh my God, I'm sitting here sober. I'm working the steps. I'm going to meetings. You're telling me that that is only a beginning? Yes. Not to scare you, not to make this seem impossible, to understand the level of change that will occur. The one thing I can guarantee each and every one of you that continue to show up to this on Thursday, continue to go to your homework group, your life will change. That is a promise I can give you. I don't know how, I don't know what that looks like, but I promise you it will change. And if we all look at the desperation or the reasoning behind even signing up to do this, the chances of it changing for the better are very, very high. Very likely. 100%. Your life will change. Remember, we're talking about physical craving tonight. And you guys are also, you're smart enough to recognize we are talking about other things. I'm just reading the book. It's just, there is a solution, is the meat and potatoes of the program. It is talking about physical craving. Next week, it goes into scratching the surface of the mental obsession. But it's also the meat and potatoes of the whole entire program. It's giving us little precursors to what's coming. So if elimination of this problem, the thing I perceive to be my problem, is only a beginning, what do you mean by that? Well, they're telling me that a much more important, wait a minute, there's something more important than me not drinking and getting high? Are you kidding me? That's ridiculous. At this point in the steps, we're not going to look too deeply into it. When we've completed this process, this time, because this isn't a one and done or a two and done or a three and done, this is a way of life. This is a design for living that really works. This is something that takes a lifetime. If I'm going to destroy self-centeredness, I'm surely not going to do it in 6 months. It's impossible. So this is a question for me to look back on. Another measuring stick. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before me, in my house, in my career, and in everything I do. Everything I do. What does that look like? That's going to require a shift in my thinking. That's going to require a shift in my self-will. That's going to require a shift in my heart. And that's what this process is going to do for us. All of us spend much of our spare time in the sort of effort which we are going to describe. Spare time, you see? Our precious time that we have that's so valuable to us. He just told us that all of them spend much of their spare time. That's kind of the way I'm allowing God to balance this for me. A lot of my spare time is spent either at a meeting, sitting here with you guys, in a homework group, on the phone with somebody else. I like to put a day or so where I'm just here engaged at home because I have a spouse. A few are fortunate enough to be situated that they can give nearly all their time to the work. And as we grow older, I think we can recognize that. I'm seeing that my children are moved out of the house, gone. It's just my wife and I here. We've been together 3 decades. So all of us have different levels of spare time. If we keep on the way we are going, there is little doubt that much good will result. But the surface of the problem would hardly be scratched. Those of us who live in large cities are overcome by the reflection that close by hundreds are dropping into oblivion every day. Many could recover if they had the opportunity we have enjoyed. How then shall we present that which has been so freely given to us? So as we walk forward in our journey of recovery, the grace of God is upon us. It's always been upon us, but we're actually turned towards it now. We're asking for help. We've reached this level of being recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. We're building our conscious contact with God. We start to recognize that by a little thought that says, man, there's a lot of people out there that really need help. What can I do to help? We go, we sit in a meeting, we listen to the people introduce themselves as newcomers, and start to recognize, you know, I ought to go talk to that person. Man, that person reminds me of how I was 16 years ago, 22 years ago, 2 years ago, 2 months ago, whatever it is. If we're on this journey and we're engaged and we're willing to go to any length, we've learned facts about ourselves, we have something to offer. And so what happens is we start to recognize, man, I've spent my whole life wondering what my purpose is. Maybe my purpose is to go out and help people that are suffering just like I was. Maybe my purpose is to talk to somebody today that's sober but kind of suffering the way I am. I don't know. That's what they're telling us that they did. So how did they come to terms with that? What were they going to do? They concluded to publish an anonymous volume setting forth the problems as we see it. They wrote this book. That's what they did. We shall bring to the task our combined experience and knowledge. We should suggest a useful program for anyone concerned with the drinking problem. And what we've recognized today is that their way of life has its benefits for all. We read that in the foreword to the first edition. Has its benefits for all. The beauty of the way that we're going through the work today. It's not our problem. We'll talk about that on page 62. We make our own problems. We'll talk about it again on page 64. We got to get down to the causes and conditions. Alcohol is only a symptom. So, wonderful program for a multitude of suffering that's going on in this world, driven by a spiritual malady. One of the requirements is this phenomenon of craving that we talk about, that we're engaged in tonight for the last week. One of the requirements, no matter what affliction we perceive to be our problem, the phenomenon of craving. Once we start, we cannot stop. Once we start, we cannot stop. That's the illness. That's what separates us from normal people. That's what Dr. Silkworth told us. Part of being armed with the fact about myself is recognizing that in my life and being able to open up about that and ask the question for someone else to contemplate. Did you suffer from that? Did you feel like that? Once you started, did you find that you could not stop? Me too. You're not alone. So in this book, it says that they are combining their experience and their knowledge. So they're going to tell us clear-cut directions. How did they recover? Precisely what this book is about. Of necessity, there will have to be discussions of matters, medical, psychiatric, social, and religious. We are aware that these matters are from their very nature controversial. Nothing would please us so much as to write a book which would contain no bias for contention or argument. We shall do our utmost to achieve that ideal. So in order to share this solution, they are going to have to talk to us about religion and psychiatric aspects of our disease, medical aspects, our social standings, things that cause prejudice, animosity, friction between human beings. So what we wrote here is asterisk number two. Here's an important guiding principle, okay? And going through the work of the Big Book Awakening, I love using this as a guiding principle. But I want you guys to also understand what the authors of this book meant when they wrote this. They just told me that they're going to talk about psychiatric, social, religious, and medical matters. And from those very nature of those matters stems controversy. So that's why they wrote this next sentence. So let's look at it that way. I'm going to share a solution with you. It's going to involve God. It's going to involve how doctors can't help me. It's going to involve how a lot of the things you've been hearing aren't true. Your willpower is weak. You just need to be stronger. Just put the drink down. Most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. So as we share the solution, when we're walking through the steps with somebody else, we have to use the utmost caution to respect other people's shortcomings and their viewpoints and their opinions and their attitudes. Mostly when it comes to religion. Because the biggest controversial topic in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous is God. So we have to use real caution, real tolerance. Evie told Bill, why don't you choose a God of your own understanding? It's the best way we can approach it when we're sitting down with somebody new. And it's the exact thing I'm going to tell you guys. Choose a God of your own understanding. It doesn't have to be the God I believe in or the God I pray to. So now I'm going to read that sentence again. Now we're going to look at this as a guiding principle in life. Because remember, we said a much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in all of our occupations, our respective homes, and our affairs. So we'll look at this in life in general. Most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings, their viewpoints, and their respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend on our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. Wait a minute, man. I'm just trying not to have a drink or a drug right now. Like, that's ridiculous. You want me to constantly think of others and how I can help meet their needs? Again, meat and potatoes of the program, giving us little hints, letting all of us know the virtues that are truly possible to achieve if enough work and God reliance is implied. We really can constantly think of others and how we may help meet their needs. Do we believe that my life depends on it? That's a serious question. Do I believe that my life depends on constantly thinking of others and how I can help meet their needs? Wow. And our asterisk says, this doesn't say that I have the ability to think less of myself. That's going to take a lifetime. It says that I must be at a place where I can think more of others. Rather than constantly thinking of myself, focusing on my own problems, mainly, rarely helps as much. So all I'm trying to do is stop thinking about myself so much. Destruction of self-centeredness, that's what that is. Start thinking about other people. You guys want to get closer to God? Everyone's, I just need to get closer. Go tell somebody you love them. Go up to a friend that maybe not is like super close. Look them in the eye and say, I love you. Just want to tell you I love you. It's easy to tell your wife you love them. It's easy to tell your best friend you love them. Do something nice for somebody. Service is the ultimate way to achieve God consciousness in life. It's the ultimate expression of destruction of self-centeredness. Because once I do that, if I'm constantly thinking of others, how I can meet their needs, I'm no longer focusing on me, me, me. I'm opening up the channel. God's already there. We're going to talk about that in step two, how he's deep down within each and every one of us. But it's all clogged up. It's not that I'm blocking him off. It's almost as I have my back turned to it. It's like a pipe that's pinched because I'm so worried about myself. And please understand that I am so guilty of that. Every day I have to visit that. I pray for the day that I'm the guy that says that God doesn't exist in my life. But I believe that this process will take a lifetime. And when I'm on my deathbed, I won't look at my children and say, I want you to remember that I died sober. I want to look at them and say, I want you to remember that I lived sober. I lived sober. I lived in service of other people. Not that I died sober. I lived it. Hardest thing I've ever done in my life. You know, we get further and further away from these drinks and these drugs and these afflictions that have been plaguing us. We get to this place of God's removed this obsession. Yeehaw. Well, what does life look like? How do we still feel deep down inside? What's really going on? Why are we here tonight? Takes me every day to take a look at that. So you may have already asked yourself, why is it that all of us become so very ill from drinking? Doubtless you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. So all the expert opinions were telling these people, you're hopeless. There's no hope for you. You're an alcoholic. You're going to die that way. We can give you a lobotomy. We can put you in a straitjacket. We can give you so much trazodone or tranquilizer or whatever they were given back then. That's what we have for you. That's our answer. In the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered. By the grace of God. By the grace of God. That's the only way you're going to face expert opinion and prove it wrong. Especially when we're dealing with an illness of this severity. Grace of God. That's it. What does that look like? How bad do I want that? Am I willing to go to any length? You see, this physical allergy is never going away. It's never going away. But the further we get away from it, and once we start really bringing our mental obsession to the power of God, and we allow him to restore us to sanity, which is what that is, the physical craving becomes irrelevant. It's no longer relevant in our lives. Because I got to walk from the malady to the obsession to get to that craving. That's the beauty of this. But it will always be there for us. And it's important. And it will always be different. There's a reason for that. My wife says, there's not a reason for everything, but everything happens for a reason. And I can't quite figure out what that means, but sometimes I try to wrap my mind around it. And as I go deeper, I understand that there is a plan, and I'm not to try and comprehend it. I just need to believe. If you are an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? What do I have to do? It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. That's all this book is about. Answer any question you may have. What do I got to do? What do I got to do? How do I stay recovered? How do I feel this joy? How do I live in happiness? How do I overcome low spots in my life? What does it look like working with others? How do I pray to God? What do you mean turn my will and my life over to the care of God? What does removing my defects of character really look like? The answers are all here. You just got to look deeper. Have an experience with it. Try it. Be willing. Be honest. Be open. The miracle will happen. For some of us, the miracle has already happened, and we want more. We can never fill that cup. That's the beauty of this. We are here to continually grow, not to maintain. To grow. Definition of maintaining is staying the same. Keep it the same. Maintain it. Maintain your car. Keep it running. No, no, no. If I maintain the way I feel some days, I'm in trouble. I'm going to go drink and get high. That's just the truth. I cannot maintain some of these emotions that run through me. I need to grow through them. I need to walk through them with courage. I need to lift them up to God. I need to talk to you guys about it. That's what this program's about. The directions are right here. It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We shall tell you what we have done. Before going into a detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them. How many times people have said to us, I can take it or leave it alone. Why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fellow can't handle his liquor. Why don't we try beer and wine? Lay off the hard stuff. His willpower must be weak. He could stop if he wanted to. She's such a sweet girl. I think he would stop for her sake. The doctor told him that if he ever drank again, it's going to kill him. But there he is all lit up again. And we could add to that list and go on and on and on with what we've heard from people. What does it create? This level of weakness, this level of I'm not good enough, this level of you're so much better than me. And the truth, I don't know why I can't do any of that. Well, the first part of the first step is explaining to us why we can't once we start. That's what we're looking at. Why we can't. Why can't I take it or leave it alone? Because I suffer from the phenomenon of craving. Why can't I drink like a gentleman or just quit? Because I suffer from a phenomenon of craving. I'm allergic. There's your answer. That fellow can handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine? It doesn't matter what it is. I can't put any alcohol in any form in my body because I'm allergic. Or any drug in my body because I'm allergic. Because all I want is more. I used to not know why. Now I know why. I have an allergy. I'm literally allergic to it. I break out in a craving that is beyond my mental control. Period. That's it. That's simple. And it doesn't make me weak. It makes me different. It makes me different. Why can't I lay off the hard stuff? Because I love it. My willpower is not weak. I sure feel like it has been. I can't stop if I wanted to. One of the reasons I'm here and going to get treatment is because I can't find a way to stay stopped on my own. Good question to contemplate is if a doctor told you to stop or you're going to die, would you stop? I never had a doctor tell me I was going to die if I didn't stop, so I do not have the answer to that question. Don't look into it too deeply because I was going through this work years back and kind of contemplated that a little too much and then got to this place like, well, yeah, of course. Well, maybe I'm not one of these people. Don't let that happen. But it's a question. And the truth is you won't have the answer to the question until the day it happens and you're actively using and drinking. That's it. And that's okay. That's an area where we can say, well, I'm not that bad. I would never do that. That's a little dangerous. So all of these observations are commonplace by drinkers. We're hearing it all the time, right? These people are giving us these observations all the time. Well, here's the problem. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. They do not know. Your parents that asked you to quit and said, why can't you just stop? Your friends, your kids, your spouses, whatever it may have been, the frothy emotional appeal that we talked about seldom suffices. It does not work. Why doesn't it work? Because back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. This is why the ex-problem drinker can get through to us. Because back of them is not a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. They can relate. They get us. And they suffer from what we're going through. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours. Remember, we're different. We're not bad people. We're different. Learning to become okay with being different. It's very important in conceding to your innermost self that you belong here. Removed from the element of weakness and self-loathing. So now we're going to talk about martyr drinkers, hard drinkers, and the real alcoholic. Moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. So we can ask ourselves, did I start off as a moderate drinker? Some of these questions, it's really good. We got to get honest here. We got to get honest. Did I feel like that? Did I think like that? Did I drink like that? Do I believe this program will work for me? Am I willing to go to any length? Am I even an alcoholic, or drug addict, or whatever affliction I perceive to be suffering from? My experience, I started off as a moderate drinker only because I was combining it with so many other substances. I couldn't really see the truth in it. Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. But here's the difference. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate. Although he may find it difficult and troublesome, and may even need medical attention. So we ask ourselves those questions. Was I able to stop if I had ill health? Was I able to stop if I fell in love? Was I able to stop with a change of environment? Was I able to stop with the warning of a doctor? That's why these questions that we go through are so important in these groups that we go to. That's our experience with it. And please understand that if you get to a place in the next 2 or 3 weeks and you're like, you know what, maybe I don't belong here. Okay, I'm not going to argue with you. My hat's off to you. If you can find a way to treat a malady without a phenomenon of craving and without ruining your life, then more power to you. We are not here to diagnose anybody. It's for you to determine. So now we're going to talk about the real alcoholic. And here we underline some things that stood out to us. And I like to have the people that I take the work on the side column write my truth. This is my truth here. And for each and every one of us, it's different. This long paragraph has a lot of truths for the real alcoholic or addict or whatever your affliction is. And we wrote here on our asterisks, this next part goes into detail about our behavior. Nothing to do with why I'm an alcoholic, but examples of the results of my drinking. From page 21, paragraph 2, through the top of page 22, underline what you can relate to. Consequences, truth. It's not why, this is more of that ugly stuff. This is more of underlining what we relate to in Bill's story. This is more of the sad wives and the blameless children and the fierce resentments and the disgusted friends and employers and the financial insecurities. Those are all results of our disease that we truly have to bring to our consciousness and not stuff them down. Because there will be a time when you need to revisit that. Talk about it as you're lifting up this obsession that's kind of rearing its ugly head in your life to God to help you get through the 24 hours. So here's a fellow who has been puzzling you, especially his lack of control. Did you have lack of control? He does absurd, incredible, tragic truths while drinking. He's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Did you change? Do you live two separate lives? I shared with you guys a few weeks back that when I told my friends and inner circle that I was an Alcoholics Anonymous, they said, why? That's how Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde I was. And then when I told my children and my wife, they said, good, it's about time. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. He's always more or less insanely drunk. Was that you? His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature, but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let him drink for a day and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. He has a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment. particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. Self-sabotage. What kind of self-sabotage was involved in your past and your lives? What opportunities were thwarted because of this illness and this disease that took precedence over everything? This alcoholic life that was your only normal life that was so important to you. He is often perfectly sensible, well-balanced concerning everything except liquor. So that's something for us to really, really look at in life. We're usually pretty determined, strong-willed, successful or semi-successful people. And if we didn't get to that point, we have the capabilities. The problem is, when it comes to drugs and alcohol, our willpower is gone. We don't know why. We have no control. We have no power. But in that respect, he's incredibly dishonest and selfish. So when it comes to my illness, it's taken over. He often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitudes, has a promising career ahead of him. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then pulls the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. Has that happened to you? Is that part of your story? He is a fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he ought to sleep the clock around. Yet early next morning, he searches madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before. If he can't afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over his house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedative and liquor to quiet his nerves so that he can go to work. Then comes the day when he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative with which to taper off. Then he begins to appear at hospitals and sanitariums. So is that paragraph your truth? Can you find similarities? Can you go to particular sentences, portions of that, underline them, and write down specific instances where that was you? That's a brief description of the real alcoholic. Our asterisk says ism, abnormal state or condition resulting from the excessive use of something. I must see that there's a big difference between the result of my alcoholism and what makes me alcoholic. Look for the problem inside, not outside. And that's what we're going to do. Once we remove the symptom externally, we're going to start to look at the problem from the inside out. This by no means is a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, as our behavior patterns vary, but this description should identify him roughly. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle with all its attendant suffering and humiliation, why is it that he takes that one drink? So now we're beginning to walk into the mental obsessions where we're going to start to head. That's going to be the assignment for next week, right? He just asked me a question. I know all this truth about myself. I just spent 5 weeks talking about the truth. I come to terms with it. Then why do I do it? Self-knowledge is not enough. Remember, just knowing this, there's such a paradox in that. Yes, we're an ex-problem drinker, armed with facts about ourselves, able to help other people that are suffering. But it's not going to keep me sober, that knowledge. That physical craving is always going to exist. My goal is to make it become irrelevant because I'm so far away from it. I don't have to worry about that physical craving anymore. But why is it? if hundreds of experiences have shown us that just doing it once means another debacle, great disaster, with all the suffering and humiliation that comes with it? Why do we do it? Why do we do it? My God, talk about insanity. That is the essence of coming to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. That's the essence of redirecting that mind. That's what God enables us to do. We cannot do that on our own. We need his help. This change of thinking. We'll talk about where the main problem really centers next week. We'll start to talk about where this is really happening, kind of in the middle. What has become of the common sense and willpower that still sometimes displays with respect to all other matters? What happens to the common sense? Remember we said last week, uncommon sense became common sense. That's what Bill meant. Right? We don't have the ability to bring into our consciousness the suffering that we've been through. We don't have the ability to allow that to stop us from picking up that drink. We're going to talk about in the next section, or maybe the one after, the 10 most insane things we've ever done. And then we're really going to talk about what the most insane thing we've ever done is. And the answer to that question is right there. Why do I do it? If I know what's coming, why am I going to do that? Who in their right mind would do that? If I know that it means that I'm going to get kicked out of this sober living, or I'm going to end up in jail, or that I'm going to lose my job, or that my wife's going to leave me, why would I do that? If my kids had told me, I'm never talking to you, Dad, again, unless you get sober, why am I over there getting loaded behind their back, trying to do it in the dark and pretend? Why? Because frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. That's why. It doesn't work. It doesn't matter what you ask me. But I can prove to you in all other aspects of my life how my willpower is so strong and how my life is so put together. I can put it on paper. Why am I here? Because I don't have the answer to that question. I've now figured out that I suffer from an allergy. Okay, great. And I'm going to believe that truth and I'm going to accept the fact that I'm different. I'm going to acknowledge this. But I don't have the answer to the question, why? Do I keep going back to it, even when I know? Why do I even think it's a good idea when I'm sitting on 2-3 years of sobriety? Why does that even though it's a fleeting thought, why is that still happening? It's acknowledgement that, hey, man, main problem of the alcoholic center is in the mind. We'll talk about that next week. That's why. And it's okay. What are we going to do about it? Am I willing to go to any length to overcome this disease? Do I believe that the people that wrote this book have found a way to stay sober and to live a productive, efficient, helpful life with actual meaning? Do I believe that? And am I willing to do what it takes to get there? Perhaps there will never be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to the why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We are not sure why, but once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. So they can tell us why we have this phenomenon of craving. We're allergic. We're different. We react differently. They're not trying to say this is why you have a mental obsession. They're just saying you do. Because they just asked us the question, if I know everything that's coming, why do I do it anyway? Why is my mind so crazy that I'll even get to this place of, I don't give a F. I'm just going to do it. That's my answer. I don't care what happens. Or another answer I've heard is, well, I know I'm an alcoholic, but it still didn't stop me. Like, how crazy is that? It's ridiculous. There's no answer. That's why that change of thinking has to be lifted up to this power bigger than us, something that we can't comprehend. That's the reason. Nobody has the answer for us. The power has the answer. The love, the grace, the healing, the restoration, the change of heart, right? Talked about changing the posture of our heart by getting on our knees. That's helping us with our mind. All of this is redirecting our thinking, redirecting our reliance, right? We know that for a while, the alcoholic keeps away from drink. As he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We're equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens. So right there, they're telling me this craving is never going away once you take that drink. No matter how long you go without. Once you drink, if you're an alcoholic and you're allergic, you're off and running. Might take a day or two. You might be able to control it for a month, maybe even a year. But if you're a real alcoholic or addict, there will come a time when you will find yourself pounding on the bar saying, how did this happen again? Or sitting at the dope house saying, what did I do? What happened? Why? I was in control. Lack of control, right? So once we take alcohol, whatever, into our system, something happens both in the body and the mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. And I can confirm that with you. I have been out there. I have tried to prove myself an exception to the rule. By every form of experimentation and self-deception. I tried so hard. And my willpower was pretty darn strong in other respects of my life, man. And I tried and I tried and I tried. I couldn't do it. And that's what brought me back here. Just one day, I said in tears, just one day, I'm not going to get loaded tomorrow. I'm going to prove to myself that I left Alcoholics Anonymous for a reason, that I deserve this. I'm entitled to it. I was in hell. I was the walking dead, spiritually broken, beaten. And what I understand today is that needed to happen to me. And it's a hard sentence, but I'm okay with it. It brought me here. Right now with you guys. So it needed to happen. So that is the first half. That is our last section on our physical craving. Your assignment for next week will be the second half of There Is a Solution. We're going to be dealing with the mental obsession for the next 3 weeks, I believe. And on the last 2 weeks, we'll be describing it very well in the chapter more about alcoholism. If you guys want a recording of this, I'm just going to ask, just shoot me a text on the WhatsApp. I'll send you a recording. I recognize you people that are showing up and I appreciate it. And I love each and every one of you, but I truly appreciate those that are engaged, that are making their groups, that are coming to this meeting. It's a workshop for a reason. There's work involved. Our time is precious, short. If you're going to do something, don't do it half-heartedly. And I really, really appreciate you guys showing up and being here. And I pray to God that you hear something that helps. I'm open to talk to any one of you if you ever want to call, anything like that. So I'm going to say a prayer. I'm going to pray us out. And I really, really thank you guys for being here. Thank you, Father, for another wonderful meeting. Oh, thank you for giving us the courage to sacrifice our precious time to acknowledge the fact that we need help, that we need you, that we want a solution, that we're willing to go to anything to get it. Thank you, Lord, for just making this process and this program available for us. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to sit here with them. Thank you for giving them the opportunity to sit here with me and just allow our fellowship to grow. Help us to be vulnerable. Help us to be honest. And thank you for sobriety one more day. In your precious name I pray. Amen.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you.